Look ahead. Imagine more. Gain insight for your industry with forward-thinking advice from the professionals at CohnReznick. Is your business ready to break through? Find out more at CohnReznick.com/breakthrough.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, we have a special and unusual guest. His name is Ross Buchmuller. He's the founder and CEO of the Pure Group of Insurance Companies. I don't usually think about insurance companies, and I certainly hadn't gone out and said, hey, let's find someone from the insurance industry. I don't get a lot of PR pitches that I'm remotely interested in, but when someone had contacted me and said, hey, are you interested in speaking with the founder of Pure? I said, hey, that's my insurance company. Person was, really? No one ever really heard of us in the media. Well, I did. I heard of you because I was unhappy with one of your competitors, and my brother, who's an insurance agent, recommended I look at this company, and I thought they were really interesting, terrific, and competitive. So I had coffee with the founder. His name is Ross. Talked to them about who they were, how they came about, and I thought it was really a surprisingly fascinating tale. Certainly much more fascinating than we typically expect from the world of insurance. So we discussed how he came up with the concept, why he left AIG Financial in order to launch this insurance company. And really, they've been an extremely successful entity, much faster growth than the rest of the insurance industry. They're over $650 million in premiums, and they're growing 40% a year. That's a pretty astonishing number. So with no further ado, here is my conversation with Ross Buchmuller of Pure Insurance.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
My guest today is a gentleman you may not be aware of, but you should be. His name is Ross Buchmuller, and he is the founder of the Pure Insurance Group of Companies. He has a storied background in the insurance industry. He began his career at Chubb, where he spent more than a decade working the fields before he moved to AIG, where he launched the AIG Private Client Group and built it into a billion-dollar business. He was president of the Private Client Group for more than 6 years. He has been recognized by Cranes New York in its annual 40 Under 40 feature, looking at rising stars of New York, as well as being the winner of the 2014 Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year Award. Ross Buchmuller, welcome to Bloomberg.
Thanks, Barry.
We don't really have a lot of people from the insurance industry in the studio, and I think a lot of people don't really think about insurance until they need it, but you've been plowing those fields for a long time, and you identified a number of interesting anomalies, not only an underserved niche in the insurance industry, but an underutilized corporate structure that made your companies more competitive. Let's start with that underserved niche. How did you first identify the niche either at AIG or at Pure?
Well, for starters, the high net worth area, which is what we focus on serving successful families, is the only business I've been in. Right out of college, I got a job as an underwriter at Chubb in the personal insurance area. And so on one level, discovering high net worth was, well, it's where I fell into. But as time went on, what we began to see, or I certainly did along with some colleagues who joined me at Pure, were some inefficiencies in the way that market had operated. Even as we brought more competition to it, there was more chance for inefficiency. But really, it was this question of an alignment of interest. If you look back 10 or 15 years ago, there began a movement where, both in the insurance world and particularly in the wealth management world, where alignment of interest, the elimination of conflicts, the improvement of transparency, they all became important, either forced by regulators who were saying you better behave better, or demanded by consumers who said, I want to be treated with this sense of trust that I know you're going to behave well. And we were able to look at the natural conflicts between policyholders and shareholders and design a business that would create this alignment, and that's what we've done.
So let's address that conflict. A lot of big insurance companies are publicly traded, which you are suggesting, and I think most of our listeners know, have a fiduciary obligation to their shareholders. But as a mutual structure where the policyholders are technically the owners of the company, there is no such conflict. Is that a fair way to describe it?
Well, I think in the simplest terms it is, but you know, it and our form takes a bit of a hybrid structure. We think it takes the best aspects of mutuality, a low cost of capital, because mm-hmm. our policyholders contribute to build up the strength of the company, and looks at some of the challenges that mutuals have had: capital flexibility, the ability to compete with larger companies, and an entrepreneurial environment. You know, maybe the best and most talented people want to work in a place where they feel like they can flourish, and sometimes the older mutual companies weren't seen as that.
Because there weren't the same stock option grants and the same opportunity for upside.
Exactly. And I think that some of the great mutual companies were terrific stewards of the capital and the risks that their policyholders presented to them, but perhaps weren't run with some of the modern ideas of corporate culture and environment. So beyond the rewards, the environment might not have been as dynamic. So in any event, we looked at this and said, if we could create a business that really embraced mutuality, transparency, the alignment of interest, the elimination of conflicts, a lower cost of capital, a focus on the policyholders, do it in a way that it was entrepreneurial, boy, we thought we'd have something terrific, and that's what we've done. But some of these conflicts are not sinister. They're simple, right? That shareholders want premiums to be higher, and policyholders want them to be lower.
Sure.
You know, so.
So as a mutual, how much lower are your premiums relative to the big players in your space?
Well, so I think the reciprocal structure probably gives us a 10 to 15% advantage. In part because, you know, insurance companies need to cover the cost of the claims and the cost of your expenses, but also the cost of capital. And when your capital is free, contributed by policyholders year after year, that certainly reduces the burden, the need to return. The other part, though, that I think is just as important is when you start a company from scratch and you have this idea of what you want to do, we have been able to select our members, our policyholders, carefully. So if you only insure those people who are more responsible, who are less likely to make claims, who appreciate what you're offering, you can do it at a lower cost. So I'd say on average, our members report savings north of 20%.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is Ross Buchmueller. He is the founder of Pure Group of Insurance Companies. Previously, he was the creator of the AIG Private Client Group. Let's talk a little bit about that. You're working as a youngster at Chubb. You're there for a dozen years. How did AIG come a-knocking?
Well, I was in London building out a UK high net worth practice and a few other things. And you know, the first thing that happened was we were hosting our chairman at the time, and two companies in the United States, Continental and CNA, had merged, mm-hmm. and they both had a consumer business. And we were hosting our chairman for a dinner with some European executives, and they said to him, "So I see this merger. What is this going to mean?" And he reflected and said, "We've never had competition, and we never will." Boy, I was sitting at the dinner saying, I'd like to compete against a company that doesn't think they'll ever have competition. And about 60 days later, I got a call from AIG saying they're exploring getting into the business and I'd be willing to have a conversation. And so, you know, I flew over from London at the time and had breakfast with Evan, had lunch with Hank, and met everybody in between. And
that would be Hank Greenberg and Evan.
Evan Greenberg as well, yeah, mm-hmm. sorry. So at the time, who were, you know, running the company. I'll never forget, you know, at the time I was 34 years old, Hank was 74 as the chairman. And he turned to me and he said, "You better take this job because you're getting too old."
at 34.
Well, and his point was a good one. You know, I had just been married for a couple of years. You know, today we have two kids. We were expecting our first child. And his point of view was that, that you know, you're not going to be able to take risks, or you may not be willing to take risks, you know, real soon when your
mortgage,
life...
Mortgage, college, et cetera.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, for 12 years at Chubb, I'm being told, you know, calm down, young man, your day will come. And here's this guy telling me
that
I better take it now because I'm going to start losing my courage to take risk. And so it was an absolute great decision, and I loved every minute of it.
How hands-on was Hank Greenberg at 74 at AIG?
Oh, you know, he was hands-on in that he was there to help you at every turn. You know, in my case, you know, he had I think we still used Rolodexes back then,
sure.
But he had a great one. And if you're getting into the high net worth business and you have Hank, you know, behind you, that's a great tailwind to meet a lot of people who could help your business. And so he was helpful in that. But most importantly, he created a clear sense of accountability. It was your business. And so his help was there, his involvement was there, but let there be no doubt that good or bad, it was your business. And you know, we got to about $500 million in the first few years when I was there before I left. And you know, the business continues to perform well. I take pride, you know, 11 years after having left, it's still a good business, you know.
So this was the pre-crisis days. This was in the early 2000s. When did you start at AIG?
99.
All right, and you were there till
January of 06, we started Pure.
All right, so you were almost 7 years, and that was all right before everything hit the fan. What was AIG like in that period? Those were really as big as AIG ever got in that.
Yeah.
That region was just, they were tremendous then.
So I just last week was with a friend who now runs a big company and who was there at the time. And we were having this reflection about the good old days, as it were, and I think the common theme was winning.
Mm-hmm.
You just felt like you had such an edge, and there was such momentum built around winning. And I think everybody throughout the organization, you know, embraced that idea that we were and could do great things and win, and people took great pride in winning. And so I think that was the first notable thing. I mean, I was long gone by the 2008 issues, but you know, that was a really important part of the culture. There was winning.
When you say winning, were there RFPs? Were there proposals that you were competing against some other companies?
Yeah.
How often did it feel like AIG was, if it's between you and who was the next closest competitor back then?
Well, again, I think that in the insurance industry, my recollection, and now we're going back a bit, but the market capitalization of AIG was bigger than the cumulative market capitalization of just about all other publicly traded insurers. So it dwarfed everybody. You
right.
know, I mean, it was a $200 billion market cap back in, you know,
I want to say 65,000 people, something like that.
Yeah, maybe even more than that. So winning was, the existing businesses were getting stronger all the time. New businesses like mine were entering and making an impact. They were acquiring Sun America, American General. You know, and there was a certain sense of confidence and purpose, you know, and pride. You know, and it was a great deal of fun, and boy, did I learn a lot.
So when you left, so you left in 06, I assume after that period of time you had a nice fat slug of stock and you got to liquidate it all before everything hit the fan.
Right. Wouldn't that be good if we could have done that? But, you know, listen, I mean, I guess I'll put that out as I was loyal to the company and I believed in the company, even though, you know, I set up a different business, but I did hold probably a little more than I should.
to say the least, although AIG has certainly recovered. At the time of the crisis, I would have bet $100 million that they would never repay $66 billion
yeah.
in aid. But apparently, they just about have. There's some tax waivers that probably gives them a little wriggle room, but they more or less repaid the vast majority of that, which is an astonishing accomplishment considering how much money was involved.
Absolutely.
So looking at what you built at AIG, how similar or different is Pure relative to that model of servicing the high net worth individual?
Interestingly enough, it's about as different as you could get. And so for it to have the same guy build both companies and to look at it now, you know, but I think it reflects both AIG's strength and what Pure's purpose is. At the time, you know, we had the biggest balance sheet in the industry at AIG.
Right.
And so for us to take on extraordinary risks for people who had art collections in the billions of dollars and to extend limits to help people insure what might have seemed uninsurable at the time, you know, that made sense. You start a business from scratch and you're now trying to operate a company where you're carefully selecting the most responsible people and pooling them together in the most efficient way.
Very different things.
And so the expertise was common, but other than that, it was very different business.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest this week is Ross Buchmueller. He is the founder and CEO of Pure Group of Insurance Companies, a specialty company servicing high net worth individuals. And let's talk a little bit about the rest of the industry and what they get wrong. What does the insurance industry sort of miss the ball with?
Yeah, well, again, I've been in the business for almost 30 years, and so I'm a bit of a fan of the industry and like to think that as a group we do more good than bad. But
I don't mean what they do that's bad. So you obviously spotted a niche because Pure has really blown up to be, you're doing over half $1 billion
Absolutely. So what I was going to say is I think where we see is you have two big issues. One is there still remains inefficiencies in this market. You know, in 1987, I joined a Chubb out of college. I went through an underwriting training program, and I came back to the New York branch where I was set to be an underwriting trainee, and they introduced a product called Masterpiece. At that time, Masterpiece was coming to New York. This was within a couple of months of me joining the company. And we looked at the first release of the product, and it had a flaw that if you were to insure a New York City apartment, mm-hmm. where you wanted to insure the fixtures and fittings or the marble floors or the mahogany walls, that they would sell a deductible from $100 all the way up to the highest deductibles of tens of thousands of dollars. And no matter what deductible you picked, the price was the same. Because they put the deductible credit in the wrong place in the algorithm. I mean, a right. silly little mistake. So here I was, a 22-year-old trainee, and I wrote a memo saying, you know, this is wrong. And anyway, 2016, it's still the same.
So if you're a Chubb insurance policyholder, call up and say, I want the lowest possible deductible, and your policy won't...
For this additions and alterations coverage in apartments. But I guess my point is it's a very inefficient market. There are lots of little quirks. All of them can be rationalized, but it's inefficient. So I think the inefficiencies, and there are many, and part of the charm of our business is this is all we do, and we have looked at these inefficiencies and found ways to make things work, whether that is the way jewelry insurance is overpriced.
So let's talk about that, because I know there's a tremendous amount of information asymmetry. It feels like as a customer, people don't necessarily know what's going on with things like that. Talk to us about the jewelry riders and how it's typically done and how you approach it.
Well, for starters, the coverage is typically restrained on their homeowner's policy. You can't make a claim for much jewelry to buy a rider or a scheduled personal property policy that is priced to make massive profits for the insurer. And in our case, we provide more cover in case you forgot to insure something. And the stuff that you intentionally want to insure, your higher valued items, are at a much lower price. So part of this is an inefficiency, but part of it also is designed for this rewarding shareholders. You know, the things that people do that everybody, even if you're not an insurance expert, just know are wrong. You know, I think we've been able to identify and fix. Years ago, there was a mortgage company that said sort of, you know, even kids know it's not right to treat your new friends better than your old friends. Mm-hmm. But insurance companies will still have new business writing companies where the premiums are lower if they've never met you and higher if you've been there for 10 years. And so we just dealt with a lot of these issues where Products are built to be more generous, priced to be more efficient, and principles put in place like treat your loyal customers better than you treat somebody you've never met.
In other words, if you're an existing customer, no one is going to come in as a brand new customer and get charged a lower lower premium. So I was kind of surprised. We bought a house about 18 months ago. I got an appraisal for the mortgage, and then we got the insurance. And lo and behold, 2 months after we closed, the insurance company sends us a note. Hey, we've reappraised your home, and it appraised for $500,000 more than the original appraisal. And by the way, here's a bill for another $4,000. I was astonished by it. Is that standard operating procedure, or is that was that a one-off for me?
No, you saw the experience the way it's probably designed to be seen, which is unfortunate, right? Mm-hmm. So here's one of the great challenges. If you're with a standard company, they may overlook real issues that would cost more to rebuild. And so when you eventually had a claim, they might not have noticed some of those features. So the challenge is, as trying to, you know, underwrite properly, we want to get these values correct, but we can't make it feel like a bait and switch.
Right.
Right. And so, you know, and simply one of the things we've done is it said if the value goes up by more than 10%, the appraiser cannot issue the report. They have to make a phone call and go through line by line to make sure you agree with what we said, so you don't have that shock. And there's lots of practices where the industry has done it the way they've done it. They believe they are right. There is some goodness in it, but it doesn't sit well with consumers.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My special guest today is Ross Buchmueller. He is the founder, president, chief executive officer at the Pure Group of Insurance Companies. You know, I was telling someone about today's show, and I described Pure, because the answer is Pure. I'm not familiar with them. My response to that was, well, think of them as the Vanguard Group of Insurance. How accurate is that?
Well, I think that for us, it's a flattering comparison. You know, when you look at Vanguard, one of the first things they say is that they're uniquely driven to do what's best for investors. And I think we share that value. Now, we use independent brokers. They're much more of a direct-to-consumer. You know, we think we are very high touch. They're definitely low cost. So operating-wise, there's probably some differences. But I think we share the value that let's focus on the customer and serve them as the most important part of the equation.
Costs matter. Transparency matters. Being on the same side of the table as the client matters. That's what was motivating me to draw that comparison. And you're hard-pressed to find someone else in the insurance industry that at least publicly emphasizes that aspect of what they do.
Yeah, you know, I think that USAA has been an inspiration for us in many mm-hmm. ways. You know, they use the same reciprocal structure. They are laser-focused on the service to their membership. You know, and so in many ways, I think we view them as someone to look up to. I would say we get most of our inspiration from the wealth management industry, where you have real evangelists who are out there trying to build businesses without a focus on short-term profits, but focused on this long-term view. If I serve my clients well, I will prosper. In the meanwhile, I have no conflict and I am just simply going to serve them well. And that gives us inspiration.
So let's talk a little bit about underwriting revenue. How does that ebb and flow with the business cycle? How does that change over time?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to be careful if the market were to become over-competitive and you simply thought you couldn't underwrite to a fair return. You know, the good news for us is we operate in such an uncompetitive world with two or three other companies. And so we see less competitive cycles than you might see in a commercial insurance where there might be dozens and dozens of companies competing for the same type of business. So we also look, though, at economic cycles. You know, in 2008, we had a significant amount of business in Southwest Florida where the economy was hitting it hard, and we had to be careful that our membership was holding up and being resilient in those financial times. These days, we're looking at the massive and frequent hailstorms in the center and south of the country. And
is that an anomaly? Is that unusual?
Well, we're trying to find out whether it is the real the new normal or uh-huh. whether or not this is a cycle. But certainly, the cost of replacing roofs the last couple of years has been more than we might have anticipated.
So let's talk a little bit about that. I was reading one of the things that you had written, and in 2004 and 2005, we had a huge hurricane cycle, and this was right before you launched. How did that run of hurricanes, especially on the East Coast and most especially in Florida, how did that impact your ability to launch a company?
Yeah, I'm sure it probably helped. You had a couple of factors going on there. So one of them was that in 04 and 05, where you had four hurricanes in 2004 make landfall in Florida, and then 2005, you not only had Wilma and Rita, but you had Katrina, who you know obviously sure. did the damage in the Gulf. So insurance companies naturally backed off a bit. And we're trying to digest what just happened, what's likely to happen in the future. And so clearly there was a bit of an opening there for us. But the real issue is this, is we were able to determine that very well-built homes, and in this case, the newest built homes, built mm-hmm. to the highest standards, were far more likely to withstand damage than a home that had been built decades before.
Go into that. There was something I had read about the larger the distance from the four corners of the house, the more hurricane resistant the roof is, or something like that?
Well, I would just say size matters in this mm-hmm. case. And so for both engineering reasons and just the common sense, these large homes held up very well. Mm-hmm. There's a terrific group, the Insurance Institute for Building and Home Business and Home Safety, that is testing damageability down in a facility in South Carolina. And we're learning more and more about what causes damage or what construction helps mitigate damage. The newest big homes were withstanding damage far better than anything else. And yet, when you were building a new home in 2006 and 2007, insurance companies were already kind of full up of what just happened in 2004 and 2005. So our concept, not limited to Florida, was what if we pooled together the most responsible owners of the finest built homes and bring them together to create their own insurance company? And it just so happened that the owners of the finest built homes in Florida were being kept out because they were all new to the market coming in, and people said, I'm full already. And so maybe a bit of serendipity, and probably when you look at any business that has great success, they can look back at some little factor that said, boy, would this business have been as successful if the Florida market wasn't mm-hmm. uncompetitive for that period of time. But the real principle was select carefully and we can build a great business.
There is a metaphor there for being willing to buy stocks when they've just gotten crushed in a crisis like 08-09. You went into Florida right after a huge set of hurricanes and found most of your competitors had been scared away. That is a tremendous, tremendous opportunity.
Yep.
So let's talk about your growth rate that this opportunity has led to. You're now doing, am I reading the numbers right, $500 million in premiums?
Yeah, so in 2016, we'll do about $650 million. So we did about $500 last year, mm-hmm. and we'll continue to grow north of 30%.
You're growing almost, is it 40% for seven consecutive years?
Well, for more than that. So since we started back, 2007 was the first full year of writing business. We grew by 40% every year, and we grew 40% last year. Those numbers, to put in perspective, we're still, about a $600 million business. We're in about a $15 billion niche mm-hmm. With only two other competitors, Chubb and AIG, really, who are in this. So we have been, in many ways, slow and steady building up a business that still is undersized within the category.
But 40% a year, that's an astonishing growth rate for a decade.
Sure. And I'm sure if I went back to AIG, Mr. Greenberg would say, so $600 million part of $15 billion, so you haven't been able to crack it.
Yeah. Well, that's motivational. How long can you maintain a growth rate anywhere near 40% for?
Yeah, I think for some time now. As I said, it's a $15 billion. Gosh, our competitors have suggested it could be a $40 billion market.
Right.
And it's a part of the economy that is showing growth, mm-hmm. the wealthiest Americans. So we see plenty of upside. We don't see any need to slow down. The issue for us is managing risk, managing culture, building scale. Luckily, from the very beginning, we put in sort of scalable systems that would allow us to grow well into the future. But that's the great challenge, continuing to find great people. We launched 47 college graduates coming in for a training program. Mm-hmm. You know, and they will help us really more in 2017 and 2018 when they're maturing, or they'll, you know,
move on.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, 27 out of the 28 we hired last year are still with us.
That's
the
great.
2010 class, the entire group is still with us. So we hope we can keep them.
So you're actively recruiting kids right out of college. How do you find clients? How does the high net worth homeowner come across Pure as an insurer?
Yeah, so we use a network of around 700 independent brokers. They are fiercely independent. They work for their clients. They put their clients' best interests first. They do work with other companies, and so if we don't serve them well, they can offer them someone else. But I will tell you that after 55,000 families have joined, it's really the existing members and their enthusiasm that will lead to the next 55,000. So, we have principally a channel of independent brokers, and then we try to inspire the enthusiasm of our membership to grow the next group.
Well, full disclosure, I was with one of your competitors, not especially happy with them, especially after that big increase. And actually, my kid brother referred me to you guys, and that's how Pure became my insurer. That's how I became aware of who you were. And when one of the people in the media group for you contacted me, I'm like, oh, I know Pure Insurance. They're my insurer. They're like, really?
Well, thank you, brother.
So let's talk a little more about revenues and reserves. How do you maintain that balance between pricing premiums so you generate sufficient flows that your reserves are where you want them to be, and yet at the same time not overcharging or staying as competitive as you can versus the other premium costs that your competitors charge?
Yeah, no, it's a great challenge, and I think it's also a challenge if you hire talented and experienced people who are accustomed to working in a stock company. Their mentality may be different. So the first thing we did is we established a set of principles that our actuarial and pricing team would use to make those decisions. One of them would be there are no new business writing companies, or in other words, the existing members will always pay less than a new member, and that helps guide them. But clearly, we have to manage this business professionally. You know that we have to make sure we charge enough, and so we lay out these principles that guide them to seek an adequate rate, to try to be fair amongst the members so you don't have subsidization where some groups are not paying nearly enough and some groups are paying too much.
Thank you, Ross, for being so generous with your time and spending so much time with us. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure and check out our podcast Extras, where we keep the tape rolling and continue chatting about all things insurance. Check out my daily column on Bloomberg.com or follow me on Twitter @Ritholtz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
Are you looking to take your business to the next level? The accounting, tax, and advisory professionals from Cohn Resnick can guide you. Cohn Resnick delivers industry expertise and forward-thinking perspective that can help turn business possibilities into business opportunities. Look ahead. Gain insight. Imagine more. Is your business ready to break through? Learn more at CohnResnick.com/breakthrough. Cohn Resnick, accounting, tax, advisory.
Welcome to the podcast. Ross, thank you so much for doing this. This is really fascinating. There's so much stuff we didn't get to that I want to talk about. Perhaps most pressing, artwork. How do you insure artwork? It's one thing to assess the value of a Picasso, because there was a recent auction. How do you put a value on any of the artwork that a high net worth household might have, whether it's original sculptures or paintings or what have you?
Well, valuation is an important part of it. And so we have a team of experts who have experience in valuations, and then they use a network to make sure that we have the right valuations. But it's only part of it. So for example, a massive hailstorm in St. Louis just hit a wonderful sculpture that was in the backyard of somebody's house, knocking the toes off of a cherub. And And so you have to look at damageability. And so from an underwriter's perspective, that's not only looking at the risks of outdoor sculptures, but understanding transit risk of pieces that are on loan or pieces that are moving from house to house. Because honestly, the exposure inside of a house installed properly on a wall, isn't that great. Once it starts moving, boy, that's there. So understanding value and then understanding exposure. And we've got a group of people who have done this for a long time, and that allows us to be pretty good at it.
Now, I understand you have some interesting artwork in the lobby of your offices. How did that come about?
Well, it's interesting. A member, a very prominent family here in New York, had a glass sculpture cut from one piece of glass by a Czechoslovakian artist who had built these beautiful glass pieces, and they discovered a tiny crack in it, but it became of no value. So we paid the claim in full, and there was no salvage value that anybody wanted. And our claim department were trying to figure out what to do with this massive piece of glass. And we thought if it was installed in the reception of our headquarters, it would be a reminder for everybody of why we're in business. And we did that. And then all of a sudden, claims people from around the country started saying, well, really? This, paper was stuck to a painting and it pulled off the treatment of the oil, and it can't be repaired. And that became installed. And then a print from Dali was damaged in storage beyond repair. And with all its mud stains, it is on our walls. And then a 12th century Chinese plate was cracked and then reassembled. And so when we've had art that has been insured and it has no value in salvage, we install it throughout our offices as a reminder for why we're in business, to help people pursue their passions of collecting art.
The gallery of damaged artwork. That's pretty funny. Let's talk. I meant to ask you before and I didn't get to it about one of your capital partners. So XL Capital, was this when you launched or at a later date? Picked up about 10% of the company, is that right?
Yeah, just in December. To back up, we've had the same partner from the beginning. You know, so Stone Point Capital in 2005, right before it left, we agreed to build this business together. To think about it, we're in the 11th year with the same private equity sponsor. And
pretty impressive.
They've been a phenomenal partner.
Nobody pressing you to go public or anything along those lines?
No, that's
unusual for private equity. They're normally looking for some sort of an exit.
Yeah, no, and so I think that in a fairly complicated transaction, we did a recapitalization of the holding company. So we have a for-profit company that manages the policyholder-owned exchange, and that's where the investors see their returns. And so in a very complicated transaction, they brought in KKR to take a minority position. And we had received over 20 unsolicited inquiries from insurance companies who wanted to be in a specialist market, liked our model, liked the predictable fee income and the customer-centric reciprocal. And I have to say that XL, they were terrific. Mike McGavick, who's the CEO, has been a good friend throughout this process. And I think that the biggest thing we get is for me is I get to talk to Mike probably once a quarter about culture and challenges and leadership, and he's been terrific. But the other side of it is, in addition to buying a single digit equity percentage, they made a very generous commitment to provide additional capital as we need it, a defined amount, but it can be called upon in a contingent capital. So, you know, if there was either an opportunity for greater growth or a crisis where we had to replenish, XL has given us this capital flexibility that's, you know, absolutely terrific for us.
That sounds like that's a good sort of partner to have. So I've covered a ton of stuff. There's a handful of questions I wanted to ask that we skipped over or ran out of time earlier. I would be remiss if I did not ask, how are your capital reserves invested? That float that the insurance company has as their reserves, how do you deal with that on a day-to-day or year-to-year basis? Obviously, it has to be somewhat liquid in case there's a need for it. It's not going into gated funds. On the other hand, the shortest-term treasuries are yielding nothing. How do you deal with that?
Well, you know, I think we made the decision that short duration, high quality, despite the modest yields, negligible yields, was the right thing. We had enough risk in our business with hurricanes and earthquakes and hailstorms that we wouldn't take enormous amount of investment risk. So it's been tough these years to generate meaningful yield, and but we like our position. We've got lots of liquidity, lots of flexibility, but surely not as much yield as we'd like.
So speaking of that, these low rates, what do these really low Fed-induced zero interest rate policy, what are we, 1.7 something on the 10-year these days? And if you're looking shorter term, it's practically nothing. What do low rates mean to the insurance industry in general that normally you're dealing with this massive float that used to be a source of profit for them?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you think about it, if you're trying to return on capital, you need to get investment returns or underwriting returns. If the investments aren't there and you need more underwriting returns, that requires you to raise prices. So having a lower cost of capital, this is a good time to be able to take advantage of that to some degree. But we buy a lot of reinsurance from people who need to see a fair amount of return. So lower interest rates naturally would lead to higher prices, and probably competition keeps it from being too much higher.
That's interesting. You don't really hear people talking about some of the secondary impacts of low interest rates, but insurance prices may actually be higher than they otherwise would. That's kind of appealing. Let's talk a little bit about analytics. We referenced this during the broadcast portion. What sort of analytics do you run? How significant is that to what you do? Would you be consider yourself a big data sort of company?
Yes, I think we would. I think you have to be successful in the insurance business these days. I mean, so from our perspective, and we've just actually made an investment outside of our actuarial area in a chief data scientist, and she has built a team up that looks at stuff beyond the products. So on the underwriting and actuarial side, we do analytics to understand the people we insure and their behavior and the responsibilities. And the risks we take, like the likelihood of a hailstorm or what type of roof is more likely to cause significant damage. But the analytics really are applying to all aspects of our business. The performance of individuals, recruiting college kids and the likelihood that they're going to succeed. The effectiveness of direct mail campaigns to how do we make sure we don't upset too many people when we appraise your house. Using third-party data that's available so that instead of a bait and switch, if we could have alerted you ahead of time that said it looks like you're underinsured, that might have reduced the shock of, you know, seeing that. And so, in any event, I don't think there's any part of the business where analytics aren't being used.
Let's talk a little bit about real estate, because I've been watching. I'm a real estate junkie to some degree. It's an area I followed for a long time, and parts of the country are just on fire. This past weekend, in the New York Times was an article about, so a lot of people have kind of moved away from Manhattan into Brooklyn in this area, and they're in a one or a two bedroom, but the cost difference from a two bedroom in Brooklyn to a three bedroom is an order of magnitude jump. And so the article in the Times was about a family, my friend Jonathan Miller, always quoted in the Times appraisal discussions, a family is looking for a house, and it was somewhere in lower Westchester, either like Scarsdale or New Rochelle or something like that. And the house was listed for, I want to say, eight and change. And they see the house the first day. They make an offer for the full listing price. And the sellers say, thanks, we'll get back to you. What do you mean you'll get back to us? That's your ask. Oh, we want to see what happens. The family comes back and makes it. Maybe it was $800,000. They offered full ask, and they come back at 850 or 867, say, we want this house 867. We appreciate it, but we have another open house next weekend. The family comes back a third and fourth time. Ultimately, the house went for like $1,067,000. And the agent, the real estate agent, said, we're seeing more and more of this because there's so little inventory, especially of quality homes like that. What are you guys seeing when you're looking at the entire country and primarily high net worth homes, the upper end of the scale? What's happening in real estate these days?
Well, Barry, I'd be remiss if I didn't stop you first and say that you don't tell an insurance guy that the country is on fire, because when we look at California,
yes,
we have seen that. So
figuratively, not literally.
Yes,
on fire.
Well, unfortunately,
the real estate market is hot. Is that better?
Yes, and literally, California is on fire right now. So this is a set.
You have a decent number of clients out.
We've just started in California in the last 2 years, and so we're
terrible time.
We're monitoring it very carefully, and mm-hmm. we're looking out. Remembered. So, what I do think on this question, that description you had of that, the $1 million sale for an $800,000 listing. I mean, we tend to play a little bit higher up. The average or the entry level for our programs are $1 million of replacement cost, mm-hmm. which on a market value could be considerably higher than that.
Right, because all you're replacing is the actual structure, not the real estate.
Exactly. But the challenge is that sometimes if it's a historic home, that costs even more, because you're actually promising to replace all the unique features, mm-hmm. but they may not have a market value. So while there's a limited supply and a great demand for homes at a certain point in time, there's also that argument going on right now in Manhattan about whether there's too much supply on the ultra high end side of that, and they're not moving as much.
Well, we had a run of prices that were almost there. Yeah, I have $100 million. I don't care what I pay. What apartment is truly worth $100 million? And now it seems to kind of be reverted as hot as the, let's call it 1 to 10 million range has been, the 10 to 100 million, or maybe it's the 30 to 100 million, seems to have cooled off.
Yeah. What I would say, though, is from our perspective is these are largely high quality problems. It creates more opportunities for us. These are folks who are feeling good and wanting to insure properly. The challenge is if you go back to 2008 when it moved in the other direction, at a point in time where the home would have been worth more to them if it burned down.
Right.
That trying to convince somebody to insure a home for its cost to rebuild when they could buy their neighbors for half the price. I think the challenges of real estate movement are so much tougher for insurers on the downward cycle than they are on a steady or upward cycle. So we're watching it. We're seeing opportunities, but we don't get a lot of anxiety about the current market.
Outside of places like Las Vegas and Southern Florida, there was a brief window where, hey, your neighbor's house is now half of what your house is. But we've seen a lot of recovery across all but the worst areas in the country. I don't want to say everywhere, but the people have described the sand states as problematic: Florida, Arizona, Nevada, and then the eastern parts of California, where the exurbs, where prices had just gone, lost any correlation to reality. But outside of areas like that, it seems like a lot of real estate has recovered. Do you still run into those sort of problems? Hey, I have to convince you to insure the full value of the home, even though the neighbor's house is considerably cheaper?
Yeah, less and less. And as I say, that it's usually the extremely unique construction, either historic or somebody put an enormous amount of money into it. They know they'll never get the money back, and we need to be able to, but we have to promise to rebuild that house the way it is. What I would say is that we have responded to a movement on the dramatic increase in new construction for luxury homes. So there's been a significant double-digit increase year after year since we hit the bottom, mm-hmm. for new home starts. And the fastest growing new home start area is 4,000 square foot and above.
That's a substantial size house.
Custom built home, exactly. So we started a new product that launched in Texas a couple months ago, geared to helping people design a home that's more likely to be resilient and mitigate against loss, with engineering services right there when you're sitting down with your architect, and then insuring you all the way through the construction project, and then once you're done, put it onto a standard homeowner's policy. And so that would be a reaction to looking at this market and saying, one, there's a demographic movement. And the second thing, back to what we talked about earlier, if your purpose is to help people pursue their passions with greater confidence, when they want to build a dream home, we should be there. And so we ended up trying to build out what it would take to help people through this construction project. And so far, so good.
That's really interesting. I have a little runabout I keep on the Long Island Sound. Nothing outrageous, but when I'm out on the water with my phone and the Zillow app, I could look at the various prices of what's been sold, what's for sale. The boat went in the water a little late. It was a very cold spring, but I noticed an amazing number of new constructions.
Yeah,
right waterfront. So if someone is doing something like that, let's say either Sands Point or where have, it doesn't matter. You guys are national,
yep,
right? Every state but
yep,
one, is
yep,
that right?
Correct. Yep.
That might be worth talking about also. I looked at the map. Idaho, why not?
Yeah.
Why not Idaho? But I wondered what happens when someone is building a home. How is that insured normally? And do you guys do something different?
Yeah, so there are specialists who develop what's called either a builder's risk or a home insured under the course of construction. And there are different types of risks, and it can be a risky proposition. You know, at the point in time where people are doing work and it's unoccupied at night, and even all the way to the end when they're varnishing the floors, there are periods of greater risk than you might find otherwise. So traditionally, insurance companies have stayed out of that business and let the construction experts do it. And then when they're done, we would take the policies. The problem is doesn't always work that tidy. Number one, there isn't a lot of service. So when they build a house, mm-hmm, and you get out there later and say, you know, you really should have put these windows in to reduce the likelihood of windstorm. You really should have put these tiles on to reduce the likelihood of hail damage. You should have insulated in this way. You should have put a shower pan in this way. You should have put the simple these nuts on in a way that will be less likely to corrode and less likely to create water damage. The value we can provide when you're sitting down with the architect right at that point in time is far greater. And so we felt like it was important to lean in and try to help. The other part of it is that insurance policies tend to be 12-month policies.
Mm-hmm.
Construction processes don't work that neatly. And so sometimes with a 13-month project, you've got to pay 24 months of insurance because they're fully earned for the annual period.
Right.
And so we thought we could design a product that would be better, and we could certainly add a lot more value, and then... Once we're done, back to kind of one of the points we talked about earlier, the people who build these homes that are brand new, those homes are much better equipped to withstand whatever loss might be coming its way, by and large. And so we have adding new members who have homes that are extremely insurable because they've been built to the most contemporary standards.
So we'll stick with the water theme. I look at a lot of these houses that are built waterfront. We had looked at one house that was on a cliff, only the cliff was eroding. It scared the bejesus out of my wife. That never happened. I really loved the view. It was on a point. And we looked at other houses. We ended up not going waterfront, but I'm still enamored with that. And I'm astonished that I sometimes see new construction pretty much, I don't know, let's call it 2-3 feet above sea level. And I'm surprised given all, you mentioned the change in weather, possibly with hailstones. How does an insurance company deal with the possibility of sea levels rising a couple of feet over the next couple of decades?
Well, certainly. I mean, I think that we use catastrophe models to try to understand the likelihood of losses and try to deconstruct them to understand what their assumptions are, including about water temperatures and sea levels. And I think we create standards by which we expect to only insure homes that are properly elevated.
Meaning something at sea level is not going to be ripe for you as a client.
Yeah, I think exactly. But I think what will end up happening is that each individual location, there are mapping techniques to determine what elevation you should have. I mean, you know, the common things which we've seen over the years is someone built a home up sufficiently elevated, and the first floor living area might be 15 feet above the ground, and it's ample and
high,
it's
and dry.
Great. Absolutely. And underneath, there's some open area ideally even vented so floodwaters would
come
flow
in and
right
go
through.
Out. Yeah.
And there will be people who look at that and say, that would make a great media room.
Yeah.
And so now you've got
or not.
Right. And so trying to be there to give the right advice to sort of say, you know, not only is that not a great idea, but you've really changed the insurability of that home once you have living area well below the necessary elevation. And so if we're not there at the right time to stop them from doing that, we can't help. But we try to select carefully. We try to advise as much as we can. Make sure that we if you want to insure wealthy families and then tell them, by the way, you can't live near the water. You know, exactly. So you
although
try to
we did see a lot during Sandy, there were a lot of buildings that had put their emergency generators in the basement, and they got flooded, and they thought they had an electrical backup. They didn't. So there is something to be said for saying, hey, you don't. If you're in a flood zone, the basement is not where you want something that is either valuable or crucial.
Sure. And so in every major market, we've got risk managers who are expert in that market. We've got people who in the Northeast, do they understand nowadays ice damming and snow on roofs and burst mm-hmm. pipes and everything we've gone through. And in Florida, they understand how to make sure that every opening is protected so that, you know, the windstorms don't damage the house and lift the roof off and everything there. And they try to provide as much advice as they can. And not only that, I think that this is where we've differentiated ourselves, is that insurance companies would make a pattern of saying, you know, Barry, you should do this. Here's a piece of advice for you between you and me, bud. But you're busy or you're not. You know, if I told you that you should put a lightning suppression system in, you think you'd know how many lightning rods were needed
No.
or how it would do it. Right. And so what we ended up developing are these group we call member advocates. I think there'll be as many as 50 by the end of this week. And they would take the advice and say, right, this is how many, you know, lightning suppression, lightning rods you need, or this is the right water shutoff valve you need, or this is the right solution. This is how much it costs. This is the vendor that we think is best. Here's a work order. I can get it done for you. The fulfillment of advice for wealthy families has proven to be as valuable as the advice itself because, you know, they're busy and they're not experts. And if you can go and get it done for them, that makes a huge difference.
Everybody is time constrained, and I have a flat roof. I'd love some advice as what the heck is supposed to be replaced. It's an 83. I know that there's new roof technologies. Let's look into that and find find something about that. So I know I only have you for a finite amount of time, and I want to get to my favorite questions. Before I do, I have one last question. So you mentioned mailers. But typically, how do you find the clients or how do the clients find you? We addressed this briefly, but I know there's more there. Given that $15 to maybe $40 billion addressable market, we see ads all the time on TV for the mainstream insurers. Geico has been running nonstop ads for it seems like 20 years. What can the high-end insurer do to find and attract the right clients?
Yeah, so I think that there are two sort of insights that have come from both research and to some degree common sense. One of them is that wealthy families rely on the advice of trusted advisors. And so to the extent that we have relationships with family offices or wealth mm-hmm. managers, that's helpful. But far more, they rely on the advice of friends and family, like your brother. And so we've created a team that we refer to them as member engagement, but they organize all across the country every month, arguably every week, opportunities to get members together with their friends and family to tell the story, member to member or peer-to-peer with the idea that they would be telling their friends a story about what happened when we rebuilt their house, a story what happened when they saved money, a story what happened when they got great advice and service. And last year we had about 3,000 of these interactions. This year we'll have a lot more. You know, insurance has been a low interest category where people wouldn't stop and say, boy, I really think I'm going to engage with my insurance company today.
Right.
And yet they're willing to and even excited about doing it. And I think that that's where we've embraced what seemed like a difficult journey to make this a subject that you want to talk about or spend time thinking about or hang out with. And so that's been really, really critical to our growth.
All right. So let's jump into my favorite questions. So you started at Chubb right out of college. Is that right? Is that what you were expecting to do? What did you study in college, and what did you think you would be doing for a living?
So I went to Trinity College in Hartford, in a classic Northeast liberal arts college, and studied economics along with art history and voodoo, witchcraft, and magic, or whatever you do at a liberal arts school. And so I was in Hartford, Connecticut, and businesses came to campus, and there were a lot of them in Hartford. I grew up in Boston. And but Chubb was offering me a job in New York, and you know, for a Boston kid who'd never spent time in New York, that seemed like a really neat idea at the time. And so I knew nothing about what they were doing. It's just that that job was in New York, and so I accepted that job, not particularly well informed. But I was going to share a house in Brooklyn with some buddies from school, and it was great. And I end up really enjoying it. And so, you know, even if it was somewhat accidental, you know, I haven't done anything else even outside of our little niche for 29 years.
So who were your early mentors?
You know, I think back to, you know, I had a childhood as a caddy was sort of one of my greatest experiences, just as a young kid going off and getting up bright and early and looping. And I got hooked up, you know, as a really young kid with some young guys who turned out to become extraordinarily successful. But at the time they were young guys. One was a young accountant who ended up becoming the CFO of a very, very big company. I watched everything they did. I really aspired to be like them. The way they treated, you know, a knucklehead kid carrying their bags, thought, boy, those guys are just great. So I think probably besides the natural thing of watching your parents very closely, I probably learned more carrying golf bags than a lot of other things early in my life.
That is intriguing. What about Hank Greenberg? You had some good things to say about him. How did he mentor you along?
Well, you know, I don't know if it was as much mentoring. I think that to everybody who worked there, he created a great role model. You watched the way he led. You know, I enjoy it. I was joking with somebody. You know, every year I share the annual report with him, and he's usually kind to write back a quick note and often with questions. And I think, you know, we all still respond to him as if he's the boss, you know, even more than a decade later. So he was great. And he was a great teacher. But I think also you realize that you don't go and say, I want to be Hank Greenberg. I mean, that is a really unique, you know, man who's accomplished, you know, so much. So, I clearly learned a lot, and have just deep respect for him.
So you mentioned you patterned Pure more on some of the wealth management firms than on insurance firms. Any particular investors influence your attitude or your approach? Who stands out to you?
Well, you talked about, you know, Vanguard and sort of thinking about, you know, the Bogle view of the world is certainly hard to argue with a lot of times, but I take great pride in being an operator of a business much better than an investor. And so I look for help from people who share the values of an alignment of interest rather than me thinking I'm clever enough to do it myself.
Any other names you want to mention or other businesses that stand out?
Well, I really think there's a broad number of them these days who fully embraced. You know, there might have been, you know, 15 years ago, you might talk about a small number of people who embraced this idea of an alignment of interest. And I think, you know, today it's become much more commonplace and almost table stakes if you want to be good in that business. So I think that's a great sign for wealthy families, but also for those serving those that it's become so established that conflicts should be avoided, transparency.
It's no longer out there on the fringe. It's becoming more and more mainstream.
Yeah.
Even if a lot of people fought it tooth and nail on the way in. Let's talk about books. What are some of your favorite books, be it fiction or nonfiction?
Well, I find, when the company has gone from 20 people 10 years ago to over 500 people today, that I feel like I read about culture and environment and organizations more than anything. So Simon Sinek's point of view, both first starting with purpose, but then some of his more, Leaders Eat Last, the most recent book. I enjoy Stephen Levitt and the Freakonomics guys, and I think about the appraisal dilemma that you described, right? The idea that someone went out to your house and increased the value by $500,000. Stephen Levitt would look at that very simply, and he would say that one day an appraiser got yelled at because a house burned down. And they didn't have enough coverage. And so the incentives are, I don't ever want to be the guy who gets yelled at because there wasn't enough coverage. So I'm going to increase it even more. And so I find that there's hardly a day goes by that I don't think about the principles that he writes about and speaks about in business and in life.
Incentives matter, in other words.
Yeah.
So what else has changed since you joined the industry? You've been doing this, you said, for 30 years. What do you see as the big secular shifts that are taking place?
Well, data and technology is probably, hard to understate. Think about it. I mean, I 1987 doesn't feel like it was that long ago. This is not, some old story where we picture, the old New York and,
When you see pictures of that era, those computers look like they're dinosaurs.
Right. Well, we would send things off to the typing pool. I was trying to describe to my daughter the other day about how I'd get an idea for a memo and I'd scribble it down and I'd mail it to a typing pool who would then type it and then send it back. And it was crazy. But what we really had back then was runners. So if a insurance broker wanted an underwriter to look at a piece of business, they would give it to a young guy who would get on his bike and he'd go there and he'd sit at your desk and he was told not to leave until you gave an answer. today, I guess that would be an email or a text or something, or they'd Snapchat me or something.
Right.
And so just the way information flowed, it was crazy to think
go downtown and don't come back till you have an answer.
And that was thought of as absolutely, common. Mm-hmm. And so the pace in which information flows. And I even think today about how I made decisions at that point in time. So they would present me with a risk and I'd make a decision. Today, I can get dozens and dozens of sources of third-party data will come in. Someone will have helped me score that risk and I'll be able to go make a precise decision. And back then, I would look and I'd say, looks good to me or doesn't look good to me. I mean, so data, technology, the way we communicate, it's a bit obvious, but it wasn't that long ago I remember when we had our first fax machine installed and we had to figure out what the skinny little paper was all about and stuff,
So if those are the recent shifts, what do you see as the next major shift that's going to come along to roil the industry?
Well, I'm not sure how much, roiling, but I do think that the insurance has been this category that is a little bit more low interest, hasn't been the thing that everybody focuses on. And as a result, there either is less information out there or the perception that the information is not out there. And so it's been a bit of buyer beware. I don't know. I don't know whether I'm making the right choice. I don't know why my home went up $500,000, whatever else it is. And I think there is, and like there has been in just about every other industry, this shift where it will move more to seller beware, and that the consumers will eventually have all the information in their hands or on their phones, or in some way they will be able to get a more accurate view of what it costs to replace their house, or a more accurate view about what competitive rates are out there, or a more detailed comparison of coverages. And from our standpoint, as somebody who thinks that transparency is great. We would love if this moved even faster. But I think it'll be a pretty big shock to the industry when consumers start being more informed.
That information asymmetry starts to become more symmetrical, and it's no longer, hey, we have all the knowledge and the buyer has nothing.
There, you know, one of our competitors actually has a video. I mean, it's true. So otherwise, it'd be just you'd think it was done from The Onion, and it says, if you were buying a flat screen TV, you probably are smart enough to figure out what to do and where to go and how to do it. But insurance, you couldn't do that. So why don't you just go to the guy that we pay money to make sure he, you know, recommends my company, and that's the best way to go about doing it. You know, and it just gets right at the heart of this issue. You know, we're talking about some of the smartest, most successful people that we're trying to serve. And there's been a view that either you're unable to understand it or you don't want to understand it because you're too busy to worry about insurance. So just let it continue to be a black box to you. I think more transparency in this information shift will have a profound impact on the industry.
And we're down to our last two questions. If a millennial or someone who just graduated college came to you and said, hey, I'm thinking about a career in the insurance business, what sort of advice would you give them?
Well, first of all, I think it's a great business. I welcomed these 47 kids on Monday and you know, among other things, shared with them, you know, the great challenge that is this business. You're trying to understand risk. You're trying to anticipate what could happen. It's a complicated business. And so intellectually, it's fun to take on challenges like how much should you charge for hail insurance in Oklahoma? I mean, it's a my advice to them largely centers around purpose. That I think that young people have it right when they want to be part of something that's greater than simply trying to reward shareholders. And we by no means are the only purpose-driven company in the world, let alone the only purpose-driven company in the insurance industry. But if you combine the good, important work of insurance, the social service that we provide, you know, and the intellectual challenge of the business, you know, but I tend to emphasize the purpose to them more because I know that they're right to go to work knowing they're doing something that's important that makes a difference. And when I see the impact that we have when we help people rebuild after Sandy, or, you know, heaven forbid if these California fires do move in the wrong direction for our membership, there's no doubt that what we're doing is important. And I think young people really appreciate that.
And our final question, what is it that you know today about investing you wish you knew? Or I'm sorry, I'm going to redo that question. I asked it wrong. Our final question, what is it that you know about insurance and risk management that you wish you knew 30 years ago when you started?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question. You know, I do think I go back to Hank's advice about, you know, don't be afraid to take risks. I think probably having started a couple of companies from scratch, it's not as if you know, I'm afraid of risk, but I naturally am not a risk taker, and I think if I wish from day one I had a little more courage on stuff, I may have done even grander things, but I'm certainly proud of where we've been.
Ross, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. This was really fascinating. It's a part of the financial world that I think a lot of people don't know about, and I feel like I know a little more than I did before we started the conversation. For those of you listening at home, be sure and look up an inch or down an inch on Apple iTunes, and you could see any of the other 97 or so podcasts that we've done in the past. I would be, again, remiss if I did not thank Charlie Vollmer, our engineer, Taylor Riggs, our booker, Mike Batnick, our researcher, for helping to put this together. Our engineer today is Mark Senescalchi. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.